Hello and welcome along to the programme. I'm Justin Brierley, your host for the next hour and a half for Unbelievable. It's the weekly show that brings together Christians and non-Christians for dialogue and debate as part of Faith Explored here on Premier Christian Radio. Straight after today's show, you can hear The Profile. That's between 4 and 5. Today, Maria Rodriguez speaks to singer Helen Shapiro on her journey of faith. That'll be an interesting one. But today's programme on Unbelievable, not the one that was scheduled to air today, in light of the recent events in Paris, a week ago, we're talking about the Islamic State. I'll be introducing my guests and the topic in a moment's time. Towards the end of today's programme, you'll hear some of the feedback to recent shows, and of course you can add your comments about today's show as well if you'd like to get in touch. That's unbelievable@premier.org.uk to email. I'll give more ways to get in touch with the show a little later on. And if you want to listen back to today's programme, or indeed the vast back catalogue of archived shows and on the podcast and so on, then simply go to the show website. That's premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. You're unbelievable. Well, welcome along to today's programme. And on the show today, we're asking, is Islamic State Islamic? The recent terror attacks in Paris, of course, have dominated our news screens in the past week or so. 129 innocent people losing their lives on Friday, the 13th of November, when terrorists launched attacks in the capital of France. A manhunt has since uncovered further plotters, resulting in a shootout in a Paris suburb. But what of the so-called Islamic State, ISIS, or Daesh, as they're called in France, the bloodthirsty group behind the attacks? Well, since the summer of 2014, they've led a merciless campaign to take control of towns and cities in Iraq and Syria, and currently actually control an area of land larger than the UK. They claim to have established an Islamic caliphate as part of Allah's plan to bring about Judgment Day. We've heard story after gruesome story of the fate of Christians and Muslims whom they consider to be apostates, beheaded, crucified, mutilated or sold into slavery. Yet thousands of radicalised Muslims from the West have joined to fight in the Middle East. So what is exerting this pull on these young men and women? What is the theology of ISIS that leads them to rape, pillage and murder? Are they simply an extremist doomsday cult? Or do they in any way represent the teachings of the Quran and Islam? Those are the kinds of questions we're going to be tackling on today's programme. And my guests are Jeremiah J. Johnson and Craig A. Evans. They're authors of Jesus and the Jihadis, Confronting the Rage of ISIS and the Theology Driving the Ideology. And they believe that, like it or not, the wicked acts of Islamic State are justified from the pages of the Quran. They also lift the lid on the role that Jesus will play in Islamic theology in a final Armageddon-style showdown at Dabiq in Syria. Jeremiah Johnson is president of the Christian Thinkers Society based at Houston Baptist University, and Dr. Craig Evans is a noted New Testament scholar based out in Canada. Well, two Muslim guests join me as well for today's show. Quite a round table discussion we're having on Unbelievable today. On the line is Inayat Bunglawala of Muslims for UK. It's an organisation set up to celebrate the UK's democratic traditions and promote active Muslim engagement in society. And joining me in studio is Adnan Rashid. He's a speaker for AIRA, the Islamic Education and Research Academy, and the Hitton Institute. And so Adnan and Inayat will be responding to Jeremiah and Craig's views in their book Jesus and the Jihadis as we host this discussion asking, is Islamic State Islamic? Well, welcome along to the programme, everyone. It's great to have you here in studio, Adnan, and everyone else joining me in various ways by phone or across the pond and so on. Maybe let's start first of all with you, Jeremiah, as one of the authors of this new book. We're all shocked, obviously, by the events in Paris. But judging by this book, Jeremiah, you're perhaps not surprised to see Islamic State perpetrating these kinds of atrocities on Western soil.
That's a great question. First, Justin, thanks for having us all in the program. And I certainly hope that I speak for everyone, all five of us, when I just say how heartbreaking it is what happened last week. And we are certainly praying for the victims and their families for what kind of response we should have. But no, I'm not surprised at all that this has occurred. I'm not surprised what happened with Metrojet recently in the Sinai. The Islamic State, their theology, it's rooted in a deeply flawed understanding of God and the human condition. And not only that, many Christians don't know how to respond. So I'm interested in the conversation today.
We're going to come to you a little bit for a bit more on the book. Coming to you quickly, though, Craig, your specialization is in New Testament studies. What made you want to write a book dealing with Islam and ISIS specifically?
Well, I have for years been very interested in how Jesus is interpreted in the Quran and early Islamic tradition. Jesus, of course, is highly valued and appreciated, even defended against various insults and criticisms from antiquity. Many Christians do not know that Jesus plays a prominent place in not only in the Quran, but in eschatological beliefs that I'm sure we will touch upon in today's program. And so that's one of the reasons I'm very interested in this entire subject, and one of the reasons why, along with Jeremiah Johnson, I wrote this book. Now, of course, I do disagree with Islam's assessment of who Jesus is and was and what he achieved. And so there very much is, I think, a very energetic and engaging dialogue to be had.
Indeed. Well, thank you for joining us for the dialogue today. Also, time to introduce Inayat Bunglawala. Inayat, thanks for being with us on the program today.
Delighted to join you, Justin. Thank you.
Inayat, just your reactions to what happened in Paris, if you would.
It was terrible. Those were terrible events that we witnessed in Paris last week, Justin. Sadly, it's becoming increasingly common to hear about these kinds of events where we're seeing groups of young men just wantonly slaughtering here in Europe. We saw it earlier last month in Turkey as well, I believe. I think in Ankara, over 200 people were killed by what are thought to be ISIS agents there as well. And then just a few days before Paris, we saw the killings in Lebanon as well, the bombings in Lebanon, attributed to ISIS. So this group appears to be intent on causing mayhem right across the region. And you know, it's understandable that everyone's thoughts are focused on how to stop this and how to put an end to their murderous intent.
And Adnan, finally, just introducing you, you've often come on to debate doctrine and the role of Islam and so on. What's your response to what we saw, though, coming from Islamic State on Friday?
Oh, it is absolutely appalling. What we witnessed this Friday was unimaginable as far as the scale is concerned, because we have heard that this was the biggest catastrophe since the Second World War in France, as far as the French are concerned. Having said that, you know, this catastrophe, to use the right word for this particular incident, has been reported differently to other catastrophes that have recently taken place. In the last 3 years, we've had over 300,000 people killed in Syria. We've had nearly 2,000 people killed in Israel-Gaza war, which took place not very long ago. And then we have a bombing taking place in Nigeria. We have so many Mexican drug cartels killing thousands of people in Mexico. These atrocities are not highlighted as much as they are this particular incident.
I suppose it's the iconic nature of the city of Paris and everything else, and obviously the scale of the fatality occurring, in a sense, on the doorstep of these Western democratic countries, and in that sense, obviously, perhaps understandable why so much focus is put there. But as Inayat said, we mustn't forget Beirut, other places where we've seen
all humans are equal. So
absolutely,
we should look at them equally. Yeah.
Great to have everyone on the program today. And it's a controversial topic, though, because I know there's going to be a strong disagreement between the two parties that we have here, as it were. Jeremiah and Craig, authors of this book, Jesus and the Jihadis, say that, like it or not, the acts of Islamic State are justified from the pages of the Quran. So let's start with you, Jeremiah and Craig. Jeremiah, perhaps first. What's your sort of central thesis in this book? Why do you believe Islamic State does, at some level, represent a valid interpretation of the Quran and Islamic teaching?
Well, in Jesus and Jihadis, we explain why the movement is so dangerous. And I think what many in the West are confused by is they don't realize how theologically driven the Islamic State is. And of course, the church has been quiet for years, not wanting to offend Muslims in general, but mostly, I think, because Christians don't understand Islam well enough to have an intelligent conversation. You know, if you want to see a case study of exactly how Muhammad desired Islam to be implemented, look at the Islamic State. And Craig and I are not the only people saying this. Even certain Muslims, former Muslims, are saying this. Rather than being an un-Islamic distortion of the Quran, the Hadith, of course, the Islamic trilogy, Muhammad's words were so important they gave it a special name, the Sunnah, which includes the Sirah and the Hadith. Of course, the Quran is only 14% of the Islamic Bible, if you will. But when you read these holy texts, and again, the Islamic State has a rational basis, and so we need to authenticate everyone's comments about Islam by looking into the holy text. Is the Islamic State Islamic? Well, Craig and I think so. Absolutely it is. It's quintessentially Quranic-centric. So again, if you want to see Islam in action, you should read the Quran. Of course, you know, Muslims believe the Quran is perfect. They believe it's complete, universal, eternal. They don't believe it contains errors, that it is the exact words of Allah. And I want to say this. I mean, Islam is not about opinion. It has a solid, rational, foundational basis in its texts. And an honest and close reading of the Islamic holy text reveals, in my opinion, that Muhammad would not only join the Islamic State, he would lead it. And so in Jesus and Jihadis, our thesis is that, you know, we can't effectively oppose the Islamic State without an adequate consideration of their theology, which completely drives their ideology. And I think a lot of the discussion, publication, and even media attention suffers from a woefully inadequate understanding with the world's second largest religion. Of course, the West is confused. Our own president here in the North America said that, you know, it was a JV team as compared with Al-Qaeda. He even referred to ISIS as un-Islamic, that it is neither Islamic nor a state. Of course, we take issue with that. You know, current opinions, I think, suffer also from this politically correct notion that focus on the group's ideology while ignoring its theology. So we assess that in Jesus and Jihadis.
Indeed, and what you say is that what they're intent upon is driving the world, if you like, towards what they believe is this kind of judgment day, doomsday scenario, which will culminate in a great battle. And for them, the way to do that is essentially in this campaign of slaughter and conquer, essentially, because they really believe that what they're doing is bringing about the end time in that sense.
Absolutely. I mean, when you look at the words of Muhammad, and when you, as again, they're in the Sirah and the Hadith, we see that 80% of the Sirah, 80%, and I want to make sure our listeners understand that, Muhammad's biography record his struggle with the Kefir. And what is Kefir? It is the word that we sometimes translate in English as non-believer. Well, it's not that way at all in the Quran. A Kefir is somebody who can be mocked, Quran 83:34. They can be beheaded, 47:4. They can be plotted against, 86:15. They can be terrorized, 8:12. A Muslim is not to be a friend of the Kefir. And I want to make this very clear. In the Islamic holy text, God does not love everyone. Allah only loves Muslims. You are either part of the house of Islam or you're part of the house of war. And I think it's really dangerous because we look at certain aspects of the Quran that discuss not showing compassion on the Kefir or the non-believers. And I really think that's the end of civilization as we know it when we're told not to show compassion.
Well, let's bring in Inayat at this point, and then we'll get a comment from Adnan as well. Inayat, hearing what Jeremiah had to say there, he said if Muhammad were with us today, he would not only join Islamic State, he would be leading it. What do you say to that?
Well, those are incredibly incendiary statements. What Jeremiah is in fact saying is that ISIS represent the correct or the most honest and truthful interpretation of Islam. If that is the case, that means that all the other Muslims, the other 1.6 billion Muslims that exist in the world, are following an incorrect interpretation of Islam. I mean, his words must be music to the ears of ISIS, but to other normal, sane Muslims, they just sound, you know, utterly, utterly outrageous. I mean, let's compare this. I mean, he makes the usual a Christian extremist analogy with certain verses of the Quran, taking them and saying, look, this verse encourages beheading, this verse encourages having no friendship, etc. We know, look, amongst Christians, you have different groups, you have different sects, you have, I mean, you know, people come knocking on my door almost every weekend here where I live. I have Jehovah's Witnesses knocking on my door. You know, Jehovah's Witnesses, I'm sure they exist in the United States as well. They famously, they don't believe in having blood transfusion. Christians. And when I asked them why they don't, they said, well, it's in the Bible, you know, not to take blood. And I said, well, what about other Christians? I said, well, those Christians are mistaken. So is it the case that Jehovah's Witnesses are right and all the other Christians are mistaken?
So you've got to accept that
people in a large group of 1.6 billion Muslims, some people are going to have some extremist beliefs and commit extremist actions, just as you would amongst the Christians and other large groups.
Let me ask you then, Craig, is that a fair analogy to say, well, Christians have their differences as well, so we have to see Islamic State in that way?
Well, there's a little bit of truth in that. Of course, there are different groups that do different things or hold different views. The problem, though, is, and I agree with what Jeremiah said, is that Jesus teaches, for example, according to the Gospels, according to Christian tradition, love your neighbors, pray for your enemies, turn the other cheek, and on it goes. And the Christian church reflects that. There may be aberrant people. There may be people who reject some of that or interpret it differently. But at the very heart and core, the very essence of the Christian faith is a redemptive program. It is not to kill and destroy. And and we don't find that at the heart and center of the Islamic tradition or at the heart and center of the Quran. And that's the problem. Now, I rejoice in what Inayat has said, that the vast majority of Muslims do not agree with ISIS. That is a good thing. And that has to be encouraged. Most Muslims are peace-loving and moderate and would not support ISIS. And we all breathe a sigh of relief. The problem, though, is at the in the Quran, there are numerous passages that can be taken and interpreted in a way that fosters and encourages this kind of extremism. And so the ISIS followers view most Muslims as not really being true to their own faith and beliefs, yes, as being wishy-washy, and they need to get on
with
it.
Well, as we know, ISIS have slaughtered many more Muslims than they have Christians in that sense. Muslims,
that's right,
they believe to be apostates in some form or another. Adnan, what's your response to this, though? Craig's point is, okay, Christianity has its variants, obviously, but foundational to it is this obvious message of love, peace, reconciliation, redemption, and so on, that you don't find in the Quran. It's easier, I suppose, in that sense, to interpret Quran in the ways that groups like ISIS do interpret it.
What I see here is similarity in behavior between ISIS and what these gentlemen are doing. They are basically picking verses in the Quran and adulterating them at will. ISIS takes verses in the Quran and misquotes them and adulterates them or changes the meaning and somehow apply these meanings or their understanding of the Quran to their situations in war. Quran is a book which has ethics in it, which has morals in it, which has instructions to worship God, which has law in it and rules of engagement with the enemy. So the verses quoted by these gentlemen are basically dealing with the situations of war. Okay, and in war you fight. You don't tickle each other's toes, right? So let me very quickly finish.
Can I give
point.
You an example just for you to comment on here? For instance, one that Jeremiah and Craig cite when they say Islamic State is Islamic, they quote from Surah 5:33: "The punishment of those who wage war against Allah and His Messenger and strive with might and main for mischief through the land is execution, or crucifixion, or the cutting off of hands and feet from the opposite sides, or exile from the land. That is their disgrace in this world, and a heavy punishment is theirs in the hereafter."
Yes, this is,
and they say, well, this is exactly reflected in the things that ISIS
do.
No,
this is what this verse deals with, is the rule, is the issue of hiraba in Arabic, which is highway robbery. So when you cause destruction in the land, you're robbing people at gunpoint or at the tip of sword. So this is a verse that deals with that situation. So
it's a
verse that deals with the criminal code of Islam.
Okay.
So it is not a general verse that you can go and apply on non-Muslims. Very quickly, I want to come back to some of the issues the first gentleman, what's his name?
Jeremiah
raised. Jeremiah quoted from the Prophet's biography that is 60-80% about war. That's not true. That's simply not true. The most authentic source of Prophet's biography is the Bukhari, Sahih al-Bukhari, which is Kitab al-Jihad, the book concerning war is a very small portion of that book. In fact, 90% of that book is dealing with ethics, morality, things to do with the rights of orphans, the rights of widows, the rights of you know, society at large. For example, there are reports like "Man la yarham la yurham," "Man la yarham la yurham," the one who does not show mercy will not be shown mercy. Another report in Bukhari, for example, in the biography of the Prophet is "Ana wa kafil al yatim fil jannah kahatain," which is in Arabic, and I will translate right now, that I and the one who supports an orphan will be in paradise like these two fingers, this close. Anyone who struggles to support a widow is like the one who struggles in the path of God. So these are some of the teachings which are deliberately ignored by ISIS and people like Jeremiah. I don't know Jeremiah much. Okay. I can only judge him by his book.
Okay.
And when I read the book, it is very selective in its choice of literature. Okay. and a very narrow
I do want to come back later in the conversation to you, Adnan, to ask whether in general you agree with the principle of the establishment of an Islamic caliphate, which I think is another interesting point. But we'll come back to that.
Okay.
Because I should allow Jeremiah a chance to respond now, both to what you and Iniat have had to say in response to this. You're cherry-picking, he says, Jeremiah. What do you say to that?
He just quoted the Bukhari hadith, Islam's most dependable hadith. And again, I'm going back to what the text actually says. And we'd point this out in our book, Jesus and Jihadis. I encourage our audience to go to JesusandTheJihadis.com right now and buy the book. There are over 200 references in Bukhari attributed to Muhammad related to jihad. Over 200. Of course, in the Quran, again, the Quran only makes up 14% of the Islamic triad. The Quran, over 100 verses in the Quran enjoining Muslims to fight, kill, torture, rape, pillage, and conquer in the name of Allah against the kafir. And again, an honest, close reading of the Quran reveals 64% of its content is driven by the question of what to do with the non-Muslim world. Kafir in all of its grammatical forms, over 400 times in the Quran. And Justin, Craig and I did our homework because we knew we would have conversations like this. I am merely quoting what the Quran and the Islamic sources said. The Quran is not about how to be a good Muslim. It is about how to dominate the world.
And in that sense, you believe Islamic State are simply carrying out what this manual effectively was created for, in that sense?
Absolutely. I agree with Ayan Hirsi Ali, a former Muslim, now a atheist, who said, if you want to see Islam in action, look at the Islamic State. It is hell on earth, and I'm quoting her.
Well, how about a quick response from Iniat, and then we'll come to you, Adnan. Let's allow Iniat to come in here. Yeah, Iniat.
It's many years back. I was laid up in hospital, guys, with having my appendix operation. And you probably heard of the Gideons. Gideons are very well known here in the UK for leaving New Testaments beside hospital beds. I don't know if it still happens, but in those days when I was in hospital, I used to have a Gideon's New Testament. So I used my time in hospital to actually read the Gospels. And I love the Gospels. You know, to this day, I have a very fond memory of reading the four Gospels. However, it's possible to do exactly what Jeremiah just did there and pick out verses of the New Testament and Gospels, actual sayings of Christ, to show Jesus not as a man of peace, but as a warmonger. I mean, there's a verse in Matthew chapter 10, verse 34 and 36, where he says, I've not come to send peace, but a sword. Now, if you just take that verse in isolation, you will see Jesus as saying that he's not come to this earth to spread peace and love between people. He's come here to create mayhem. Now, I could have done that. I could have done exactly what Jeremiah just did there, and Craig was doing. But I don't, because it's so foolish to take bits of scripture and try and paint a character or ridicule the whole of the rest of the scripture with it. You mentioned Jeremiah that there were 200 hadith or sayings of the Prophet in Bukhari, which talk about jihad. Those are 200. How many sayings are there listed in Bukhari? I think it's over 10,000 sayings in there. So to just focus on hadith which relate to jihad, and jihad is a concept regarding safeguarding your society, expanding the domain of Islam or the land where Islam is ruling. This was, remember, a situation where there were a tiny little state surrounded by pagans.
Well,
let's
quickly allow Jeremiah a response. I suppose, Jeremiah, my question is, and feel free to phrase it yourself in a sense, but is the problem for you that the fact that Islamic State does exist and other terrorist groups spring out of Islam, suggestion that they do obviously take these verses in a particular way that the Christian Bible doesn't seem as susceptible to in that sense?
Absolutely. And Craig, I want you to speak to Matthew 10 for the benefit of our audience. How should Christians respond when Muslims cherry pick these verses out of the Gospels about Jesus, especially as it relates to the Matthean Gospel?
Craig, do you want to pick that one up?
Well, sure, of course. There are a handful of verses. Matthew 10:34 is one of them, where Jesus, in context, it's obvious he's speaking metaphorically. He uses hyperbole. He, in fact, in Mark 9 says it's better to gouge out an eye if it causes you to sin than to go to hell with both eyes. And it's obvious in context what it is. But even then, we only have a few verses like that. We don't have dozens, even hundreds in the Gospels. And so what Jesus's message is very clear. And that's why it's very rare that someone cherry picks Jesus and comes up with a very false understanding of him. But I do support what Jeremiah is saying. In the Quran, it's different. And in the Hadith and so forth, you've got a lot more material. Another way of saying is a tree is known by its fruit. Just look at the world today. Where is all the violence taking place? The vast majority of wars and oppression and people fleeing and refugees. It's people fleeing from Islamic-dominated governments and societies. Fleeing where? To the West, which has a long legacy of Christian influence.
Adnan.
Craig. It doesn't this legacy doesn't save you. If you study the history of Europe or the Christian West carefully, you will see mass burnings of witches, mass burnings of heretics. You will see crusades. ISIS is as Islamic as the Crusaders were Christian. Okay, ISIS is as Islamic as the KKK were Christian. ISIS is as Islamic as the Mexican drug cartels are Christian. They wear crosses. Some of them actually go to churches. You know, Pablo Escobar, one of the biggest drug barons in Colombia, who was killed in the 1990s, was a very charitable Christian. He was doing charity from his drug money. Okay, and he was trying to quote Bible for his actions. Now, do we claim that Christianity is responsible for that? No, of course not. We don't look at things like that. You know, we look at things in an academic way. Very quickly, I want to come back to, I do apologize, but this is very important because Craig and Jeremiah have raised few issues. Hirsi, why do we take Ayan Hirsi Ali's opinion over the Mufti of Saudi Arabia or the Sheikh al-Azhar or the scholars of Indonesia or the scholars of Pakistan? The entire Muslim world and the scholarship has condemned what ISIS does. It's a death cult. This group is going out killing innocent people. What about the teachings of the Prophet? I mean, Jeremiah talked about Bukhari, 200 reports. As Inayat already pointed out, there are thousands of reports out there, 7,000 reports in Bukhari, close to 10,000. Okay, why do you ignore all the rest? Let me finish my point very quickly, please. In the same book, we find instructions that when in war, do not kill men who are not non-combatants, do not kill children, do not kill women, do not cut trees, do not destroy fields where you find harvest, do not even kill monks, Christian monks who are in monasteries. You go to Kitab al-Jihad in Muwatta Imam Malik, all the reports are there. Same prophet is teaching these rules. So when do you go to war? Quran is very clear. It's all defensive. When you are attacked, for example, chapter 2, verse 190-192, it's clearly there that when you're attacked, defend yourselves and do not go to extremes. Wala ta'tadu. What is extreme? Prophet, explain what is extreme. So here what Jeremiah and Craig is doing is absolutely, he mentioned pillage, rape, robbery. Please, please be just. Do justice to our text and don't misquote it.
We're going to have to go to a quick break. And what we'll do is we'll come back and we'll see what Craig and and Jeremiah have to say in response, and of course Iniat, who joins us by phone as well. We're asking today on Unbelievable, is the Islamic State Islamic? Of course, this is in response to the recent terror attacks in Paris, which have dominated our news screens. So do come back again in a short moment's time as we continue this debate. Did you know Christmas is the most likely time that someone will say yes to an invitation to church? So why do so few Christians invite their friends? In the latest Premier Christianity magazine, we explore the 12 nays of Christmas, the most common reasons people give for not inviting, and practical advice on how to overcome our fears. Also this month, hear stories of help, healing and hope at the Church for Refugees in Lebanon, and the world's greatest living explorer, Sir Ranulph Fiennes, chats to us about his faith in some of the most remote locations on earth. Get your free copy now at premierchristianity.com/freesample.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back to the second part of today's programme. I'm Justin Brierley, your host for Unbelievable. It's the show that gets Christians and non-Christians talking. And today we're, of course, doing a special show. Is the Islamic State Islamic, we're asking. Now, if you're waiting for news about what happened to the show that would have happened this week, we were due to have Oz Guinness and another guest for a discussion. Well, we've put that on the back burner for another time because we felt it was right to respond to the recent attacks in Paris, which have dominated our news screens for the past week. What do we make, though, of Islamic State? Well, Jeremiah J. Johnson and Craig A. Evans join me. They're authors of Jesus and the Jihadis, Confronting the Rage of ISIS and the Theology Driving the Ideology. I'll make sure there are links, by the way, to all my guests, the book and so on, from the Unbelievable webpage. So if you're interested in finding out more about anything you've heard on the show, that's the place to go. PremierChristianRadio.com/Unbelievable. Also joining me in studio is Adnan Rashid from the Islamic Education and Research Academy, and also Iniat Bunglawala by phone. So lots of guests and Iniats from Muslims for UK, and we'll make sure to try and give everyone as much time as we can during the discussion. Jeremiah, in that last section there, Adnan saying you're misrepresenting Islam. I won't judge you by the KKK or the Crusades or whatever. Don't judge us by Islamic State and the way they interpret the Quran. Response to that, but also there's some very interesting material in the book as well about the role Jesus plays in the theology of Islamic State. Many people might think, Jesus, that's the last thing surely Islamic State would be interested in talking about. But in fact, they do believe Jesus plays a role in their plans. So firstly, maybe responding to Adnan and the role of Jesus in Islamic State's theology.
Well, thank you so much for the opportunity to respond to Adnan. And again, for the benefit of our audience, study after study, they've quantitatively noted, and I hope you're taking notes if you're listening to this, 132,315 words are devoted to jihad in the Islamic trilogy. And as we said in the first part of our program, the Islamic trilogy should be taken together. It is the Hadith, the Sirah, and the Quran. Now, by comparison, for our audience, the New Testament is made up of 138,000 words in the Christian New Testament. So I think that's a striking meta-narrative when you just look at the amount of content. And so I certainly don't want to be judged by the KKK. I want you to judge Christianity by the Bible, by the New Testament. And when we look at that, that can be an entirely different conversation. But the Old Testament, there are 34,000 words that have some reference to violence in the Old Testament. And again, the Old Testament is much larger than the Quran. Of course, the Quran itself is smaller than the New Testament. So I want to make sure our audience knows when they compare the Quran proper to the Bible, you're comparing a much smaller body of literature. Comparatively, when you look at the Islamic trilogy, there are 325,000 violent words in the Quran. So I don't have an axe to grind. Some of my best friends are Muslims. My friend Farhad, who I worked out with for years, just made the Hajj. And he's one of the reasons, Justin, I think that Craig and I were excited to write this book, Jesus and the Jihadis, because many Christians simply don't know how to respond to Islam, to the Islamic State. They're intimidated by it. They know little to nothing of the Quran. And my friend Farhad, when we'd work out three times a week, he would say, Jeremiah, we just worship the same God. You just worship Yahweh, I worship Allah, it's the same God. And so we wrote that for that purpose. Now, would you like me to move on to the ISIS endgame?
Just give a little sense of yeah, the theology driving this particular kind of apocalyptic vision that ISIS have and how Jesus plays into that.
Well, I want to say this, Craig and I, as we research for this book, I mean, it's amazing. Some things just can never be unseen. Yesterday, world headlines in Dabiq magazine, that is the propaganda magazine that looks like a train wreck between Sports Illustrated and a Walking Dead comic, is literally what Dabiq is like. Craig and I simply cannot unsee the things we've seen. Yesterday, they were showing pictures of what the bomb would have looked like that brought down the Metro jet. And so we don't need, none of us on this panel, we don't need to speculate what the ISIS endgame is. I mean, when you read Dabiq, the propaganda magazine, Isa, Jesus, figures prominently in it. And I want to make sure our audience understands that according to Islamic eschatology, and when we say words like eschatology, we're talking about the doctrine of the end times, Jesus is the ultimate Muslim. And as Craig said earlier in the show, Jesus is revered second only to the Prophet Muhammad in the Islamic trilogy. And so when Jesus comes back, he will kill all the Christians. He will end Christianity and Judaism. He will Hajj. He will marry. And he will die. So in effect, Jesus, according to Islamic traditions, will bring about the end of the world as the ultimate Muslim.
And it's quite a colourful description as well in the literature of this character, and as Jesus returns to sort of, in a sense, finalise the battle that Islamic State believe they're obviously fighting. That may be news to many people. Whether it's Islamic State or not, though, Iniat, is that a fair assessment of the general view of the end? What you know sometimes is called technically the eschatology of Islam.
It was worth bearing in mind that a lot of what Jeremiah just said about the eschatology of Islam is not actually in the Quran. Remember, Muslims believe the Quran is the word of God. After the Prophet died, his companions naturally were very keen, or succeeding generations were very keen on trying to collect the actual sayings of the Prophet, the words he uttered during his life. And those came to be collected in the centuries following the death of the Prophet. So that first collection of Sahih Bukhari, which is held by Muslims to be perhaps the most reliable of all the collections that we have, even that collection is dated to over 200 years after the Prophet died. So this mention of Christ coming back and breaking the cross, etc., these are all from the Hadith. None of these verses are actually in the Quran. So this has always been a very a rather controversial matter amongst Muslim theologians. In the Quran, the only thing the Quran says about Christ is almost nothing about the eschatology. It is almost all centered around Christ not being God, that Christ was worshipped as a god on this earth, and he's asked, "Did you tell people to worship you?" And he says, "No, I told people to only worship you. I only told people to worship God. It is others who made this claim that I am God." So the Quran is very firm. Its teaching center around that the fact that Jesus should not be worshipped as God, and that he is a prophet, a great prophet, certainly a man who was a great teacher, but definitely not God. And it regards the worship of Christ as idolatry, one of the most serious sins in Islam.
Where do you stand personally, then, on the status of those surahs regarding...
In all honesty, I think these verses to do with Christ coming back, or the sayings about Christ coming back, were almost certainly influenced by Christian communities in the Middle East. So I'm not at all
you
convinced.
You don't put as much store in them.
Back at all.
Okay.
I'm regarded as a later adulteration in the Islamic teachings.
Okay, we'll come back to you. We'll have you on in a moment, Adnan. Just wanted Craig to come in on that, because obviously you've contributed some material in the book, Craig, talking about the Islamic view of Jesus, which Iniat has mentioned there. Obviously, Iniat believes that the Quran gives a better view of Jesus. He was not God, and many Muslims, Adnan included, would say the Gospels themselves do not represent a divine Jesus, and where they do appear to, that it's because of later influences and so on. What's your take on this in the way that Islam represents Jesus generally in the Quran and so on?
Well, I think we need to keep chronology, historical dates, firmly in mind. The Quran is written down in the 7th century, and of course, as has just been said, the Hadith is much later. I find it interesting that it was acknowledged that the Hadith really cannot be trusted. I agree with that. The four New Testament Gospels that relate the life and teaching of Jesus, including his crucifixion and resurrection, they are first century. We have the words of Jesus in some of Paul's letters, which were written in the middle of the first century. In other words, the New Testament contains details about Jesus's life, death and resurrection in sources written when eyewitnesses were still living, even family members like his brother James. And yet in Islam, there's a preference for what is in the Quran written about 600 years after the time of Jesus. Now, from a historian's point of view, earlier sources, multiple sources, will always be preferred over a single source that is hundreds of years later. And Jesus's followers came to believe in his divinity because of things he said, things he did, and especially the resurrection. Paul is a great example of that because he was not one of Jesus's original followers. He opposed Jesus's movement until he was encountered by the risen Jesus on the road to Damascus. That changed his life. He then recognized the divinity of Jesus and actually applied to him verses from the Jewish scriptures, the Old Testament, that were originally speaking of God, the God of Israel. So profound was this vision. I would trust Paul any day because he knew Jesus's disciples, he knew his brother James, he met the risen Jesus, he was there in the first century, rather than somebody who has visions and dreams and is writing 600 plus years later.
Okay, Adnan, do you want to add anything in?
Yes, absolutely, because there are so many things that were thrown in the middle, and I would like to have quick responses to them. Firstly, the number of words, 132,000 words or 60,000 words or 25,000 words, this means nothing. What we'll have to look at is the context and the content. Okay, when we look at the content of these verses and the context in the Quran or other sources, what he calls a triology, what Jeremiah calls a triology, when you look at the context, nothing whatsoever justifies the murder and the killing of innocent people. To the contrary, we have severe penalties stipulated in this literature against those who kill innocent people, women, children, and civilians for that matter. If we go to the Old Testament, genocide is justified there. If it is the word of God, as Jeremiah and Craig will claim, then they have to agree with genocide. Okay, because I mean, you don't want me to quote the verses. 2 Samuel chapter, 3, chapter 15, verse 1 to 3. It's there. It's clearly there. Moses telling his followers in the book of Numbers, chapter 31, verse 17 and 18, that take young girls for yourselves and kill all other women, children, and men. Right? And then we have in the book of Leviticus, where we find in chapter 20 and 21, women can be burnt alive if they are accused of unchastity. Okay? So in these cases, some of the Europeans throughout ages, in the previous, pre-Enlightenment period, people were being burnt alive because of these verses. There were hundreds of thousands of women burnt alive by Christians because they appealed to the Bible, okay? And the last witch to be burnt in Europe was burnt in 1782, not very long ago, in Geneva. Out of all places, and the last witch to be burnt in the UK was burnt in 1726 in Scotland. Okay, so is Christianity responsible for all of this? If Christianity is not responsible for all these atrocities, as clearly Jeremiah and Craig will argue, then why is ISIS responsible for Islam, or Islam responsible for ISIS? Very quickly, let me go back to other points. Gospel is loving, and it has a lot of beautiful verses, which I agree to this point. Gospels are amazing documents, beautiful documents, a lot of beautiful teachings in there. And I admire them. Mm. Okay, whether they actually come from Jesus or not is another question altogether. But there are beautiful teachings there. Buddhism, I find it more appealing if we want to be pacifists and we want to spread love and justice and peace. Buddhism is a pacifist religion. Okay, why don't we follow Buddhism if we want to argue like that? Mm. Comparison between Bible and the Quran, and these are two different documents historically. As for eschatology, very quickly I want to address this point. Anayat raised a couple of points, and so did others. Islamic eschatology is very clear. First of all, it begins with the Quran. Quran clearly, categorically states that Jesus will return. Mm-hmm. In chapter 4, verse 159, he will return to put the record straight.
Okay.
Okay, it's there in the Quran. So, Anayat was, I think, he has misconstrued.
You'd go a bit further. You'd say it is clear from the Quran that Jesus will have a role in end time.
Absolutely, but not the way ISIS is painting him. Okay.
Right. Okay.
It's very clear that Jesus will not come and, in fact, I believe if Jesus was to return in our life, he would probably end up fighting ISIS. Okay.
Right.
So, Jesus will be on our side. Jesus will be on the side of good people. People who follow Islam to the letter, people, the majority Muslim in the world. And this is a small group which represents only itself and its corruption of our faith, nothing else.
Okay, well, I will let Jeremiah and Craig come back to some of those objections you had to what they had to say. Just briefly, though, and I alluded to this earlier, Adnan, do you, however, as a Muslim, still nevertheless believe that Islam does need to establish a caliphate? That this is the only true way in which Islam can be fully expressed through a governance which is absolutely governed by a Sharia law, by, you know, and that outworking, as it were.
Okay, this is a very good question. First of all, what do we mean by caliphate? Just like a secular state. Okay, what do we mean by a secular state? North Korea is a secular state. The U.S. governs by secular laws. Okay, Britain is a secular state.
Mm.
But there is a difference in the secularism, how secularism is actually practiced. There's a huge difference. Likewise, someone can come along and say, I have a caliphate. Okay, but it doesn't look nothing like caliphate because caliphate is very clearly defined in Islamic literature. Having said that, it is not the only way to govern legitimately, according to Islamic literature. We have had legitimate kingships, dynasties that were deemed completely Islamic by the scholars of the time. For example, we had the Ayyubid dynasty. We had the Delhi Sultanate, for example, in India. We had the Seljuk dynasty. We had the Ottomans, okay? We had the Mughals in India, okay? And there were periods where the ulama, the scholars, considered them to be completely Islamic without calling them a caliphate. So caliphate is the ideal situation as long as it is practiced or it is applied.
Don't believe, obviously, Islamic State have established a caliphate?
I don't believe. I mean, just to claim that I have, a gold medal and it's only gold plated, you know, it doesn't make it gold medal, does it?
Do you know people who have gone to join them, though? Do you know anyone who has?
I don't know and I wouldn't like to know.
Right. I mean, I'm just kind of trying to establish what is the attraction, though, that has led thousands of
people? This is a very good question. Coming back to issue Jeremiah and Craig have raised in the book as well. I mean, it is amazing that they have the time to sit down and write a book on a death cult and have nothing to say on atrocities committed by the U.S., atrocities committed by Israel, atrocities committed by Russia in the past 30 years. They have nothing to say on that. What about Israel? Has Israel ever done? I mean, there is Christian Zionism. There are Christian churches in the U.S.
Are you saying that some of these things are what drive people to embrace Islamic
atrocities,
State?
When atrocities are committed. Look at these French, the French case. Who were these bombers, these terrorists? Who were these people? Some of them were smokers of weed and skunk. They were on drugs. Some of them were not even praying. What kind of Muslim would do something like that and go and commit an atrocity in the name of Islam? So they are as Islamic as the drug cartels in Mexico are.
They're just looking for some Christian kind of... I mean, okay, Jeremiah, lots there that Adnan has had to say in response to you.
Well, first, I want to thank Adnan for speaking out against the Islamic State. I want to thank INEAT for doing that. That requires a lot of courage and boldness on their part. So with respect to those issues, we agree, and I really compliment you guys for doing that. I know the risks that you take within Islam doing that as well. But I want to make sure our audience knows this. You know, we're speaking so people can... This is an educational program. Muhammad's success, when you study his life, and again, I'm a historian, so if you'll give me just a couple of minutes, Justin, when you study the success of Muhammad's life, his success depended on politics, not on preaching, teaching, or religion. So before you turn me off, I want you to hear this, and I'd be anxious to hear a response from our guest, and Craig as well, of course. The Sirah, again, Muhammad's biography, for those of you that are at home, it gives a detailed account of his rise to power. when he preaches in the religion of Islam for 13 years in Mecca, he has around 150 followers. So Islam grew those first 13 years, give or take, at about 12 or 13 converts a year, if you will. So probably around 12 or 13. Muhammad then, of course, is forced to move to what became known as Medina, as we know it today, and he becomes a politician. He becomes a warlord. And during the last 9 years of his life, and again, I am quoting from the Islamic trilogy, during the last 9 years of his life, Muhammad was involved in an event of violence every 6 weeks. When he died, every Arab was a Muslim. So it's important that we understand that when he goes to Medina, and we can talk about the principle of these verses superseding the Medina text from the Meccan text, Islam, when he becomes a political reality, a warlord, grows at 10,000 converts a year. And I think it's important that our audience understands that. The other thing that I would like to say is I just want to praise God for a moment as a Christian. And Justin, we can talk more about this if you like. More Muslims have come to faith in Jesus Christ, the Messiah, in the last 10 years than in the previous 14 centuries combined. Muslims, there are millions of peace-loving Muslims around the world, and they're seeing that it is a bankrupt religion, and they are coming to faith in the Prince of Peace, Jesus Christ.
Can I quickly come back on that,
quick,
please?
Quick comeback, and we'll have Iniat then, Adnan.
Okay, first of all, when Jeremiah accuses the prophet of being a warlord, tell me how a warlord can actually fight to defend his community. His community was facing annihilation because they were following that faith. He was besieged by an army of 24,000 men. If Jeremiah was to read the same literature carefully, he will see that 99% of the prophet's wars were defensive in nature. He was attacked. Even in the last year of his life, Romans were threatening him that they will attack him and annihilate him. So please read the literature carefully and read it with context and don't read it selectively. Also with regards to conversions to Christianity, I mean, I can make the same claim. Islam has been the fastest growing religion in the world. On the back of that very book, it states in the 20th century there are 200 million conversions to Islam. And there's a question raised, why? And there's a reason why. Because Islam appeals to people. It's a beautiful faith. It's not confusing. It's very straightforward. And it's loving. It's compassionate.
Well, you can understand why some people in the West don't get that impression when obviously a lot of what is seen on our television screens is associated with bombings, hatred, and everything
I know
else.
A lot of people in the West who have converted to Islam willingly. No one's forcing them. And with regards to 10,000, the number 10,000 that converted, show me one case where anyone ever in the lifetime of the Prophet was forced to accept Islam. One case. It's a challenge. You've read the literature.
Jeremiah, do you want to respond before I should bring in Ayat back in, who hasn't spoken for a little while, but yeah. Good.
You know, I want to defer to Craig. I feel like he's not had enough time to respond, Justin, if you don't mind.
Any thoughts on what's been said up to this point, Craig?
Well, you know, let me throw out a hypothetical question. We have thousands of young men and even some women desperately trying to get to Syria or Iraq to join ISIS and fight for ISIS. I wonder how many Muslims are trying to get to the Middle East to fight against ISIS. If what our guests have said is correct and that ISIS is so far out of alignment with Islam, why haven't volunteers in great numbers come to defeat ISIS and show the world that Islam truly is peaceful at its core, peaceful, peace-loving, and so forth? Why is it that it's only Western countries, for the most part, that send in forces into danger to Iraq and to oppose ISIS? I find that curious.
You're referring here to some of the Muslim-governed countries specifically, Craig, which have chosen not to get involved in the conflict.
No, that's right. I think Craig is not
right.
Not
I'm talking
watching.
About countries outside. I'm talking about countries outside of the Middle East. Obviously,
let
Turkey.
Correct, Craig. Here.
Why don't we allow Iniat to respond? I feel we should bring
sure.
Iniat in. Go ahead, Iniat.
Thank you for that. And I first Craig's just recent intervention about why Muslims are not taking on ISIS to be quite a staggering statement. Let's bear these facts in mind. ISIS did not exist 10 years ago. It was only after the U.S. government and the U.K. government, allied with, I think, Spain, you know, very few countries, waged an illegal war against Iraq, where they had no United Nations backing, where you had an American president who has admitted to us that God told him to invade Iraq. Mm. So a Christian president in America, allied with a Tony Blair here in the UK and Spain, went to war in Iraq without any backing from the United Nations, overthrew the regime of Saddam Hussein, created chaos in that country, which allowed Al-Qaeda and then later ISIS to establish themselves in a land where they had no presence whatsoever before. It was allied actions. It was the U.S.-led actions which led to the chaos in Iraq and the vacuum of power in which ISIS and Al-Qaeda later thrived. So it is astonishing, after creating that mess in Iraq in the first place, that Craig now turns around and has the nerve to ask Muslims, why don't you go and do something about it now?
Craig, do you want to respond, Craig?
Phenomenal.
Okay, Craig.
Yeah. Without disputing what has just been said about whether it was well advised or not to overthrow a mass murderer, Saddam Hussein, just let that go, I still raise the question, if ISIS is so obviously un-Islamic, why aren't Muslim nations outside of the Middle East, why, like Indonesia, for example, why aren't Muslims volunteering by the tens of thousands to oppose this evil aberration of Islam? I just find that curious. And I think the lack of active opposition to ISIS on Muslims' part around the world, I think what that shows is that what Jeremiah and I have said in Jesus and the Jihadis is in fact an accurate reflection of what Islam and Muhammad really were at their heart at the beginning. And the whole history of Islam, aggression and so forth, shows that.
We're going to have to take a quick break and then we'll come back for final thoughts. We've had a really intense discussion today on Unbelievable, asking, is the Islamic State Islamic? And it's taken us in various directions. If you'd like to contribute your thoughts on today's programme, you're welcome to get in touch by email, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. If you'd like to send me an email, I'll try and read as many of those out in the next programme as we can. And I'll give you other ways to get in touch as well towards the end of today's show. Taking a quick break now, and we'll be back in a moment's time. Welcome back. I'm Justin Brierley, and this is the third and final part of Unbelievable as part of Faith Explored. Today, debating the Islamic State. Well, as I've mentioned, you can get in touch with us about anything you hear on today's programme. You can do that via Facebook and Twitter as well. Many people follow the show via Facebook and Twitter. Facebook.com/UnbelievableJB or @UnbelievableJB for my Twitter account. And I always enjoy getting your messages that way as well. Thanks very much, for instance, to someone who got in touch via Facebook. If I can just dig out the correct bit of paper. Bill said, just wanted to say hello from New York. I work as a police officer and I always listen to your show in my spare time. If it wasn't for your show, I may have lost all hope in my faith years ago. Thank you for what you do. Bill, thank you very much for getting in touch. And if you'd like to get in touch, then do also email unbelievable@premier.org.uk. We'll be hearing some of your mails a little bit later on in the show. Quite a few people as well leave their comments underneath the show online. So if you go to the webpage, you can start to add your thoughts to the programme as well. That's premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Links there, of course, to where you can find the podcast, features, videos, articles, and much more besides. Don't forget that after today's programme, there's The Profile. Maria Rodriguez speaks to Helen Shapiro, who is, of course, so well known as a singer. Had some fame, didn't she, in the 60s and 70s with some of her hits reaching the top 10. But she'll be talking about her life and faith growing up in a Jewish household. Now, next week on the programme, there is no Unbelievable on air. That's because we're giving space, as we often do, to our fundraising appeal, Together Now. So although there won't be an on-air show, show as we make space for that. I will be putting something out on the podcast feed. I often put out a little something different or special, and so look out for that arriving in your podcast feed on Saturday next week. But I would like to take the opportunity to remind you that the week after that, we will be doing a special 10-year anniversary program. Unbelievable has been on air now for almost 10 years. In fact, this coming week marks the 10th year since we first broadcast the first Unbelievable programme on, I think it was the 26th of November 2005. So what we're doing for that, as well as hearing some of the past programmes, a little bit of the very first show as well, we're going to be taking your questions. Ask me any question and I will attempt to answer it. Obviously, something to do with Unbelievable, what I think about some of the shows and topics and things perhaps that have gone on and all of that stuff. I'll try and do my best to answer your questions. If you want to send in your question, you can email unbelievable@premier.org.uk and the other ways as well, of course, Facebook, Twitter and so on. I'll take them that way as well. So look forward to hearing what you want to ask me about that. Unbelievable and Faith Explored is, of course, brought to you in association with Premier Christianity Magazine. I edit the magazine. The latest edition has just landed and you can get yourself a free sample copy if you want to. premierchristianity.com/free sample. We've been doing a lot of blogging though in the past week, obviously in response to the attacks in Paris. Some of those were responding to the Christian calls for praying for Paris and some practical ways in which Christians could do that. The hashtag pray for Paris hashtag became quite popular shortly after the events took place. But probably the one that's caused the most response has actually been by French ex-atheist Guillaume Bignon. He joined me actually for an Unbelievable debate last year. And I asked him to write with his reflections as a former atheist on how he makes sense of the evil in Paris, which he did. He made really in the blog a case for the moral argument for God, if you like, and saying that in the end, atheists, as in he was one of them, cannot give an account of why these acts are really evil. Only if there is a God can we say that something is truly right or wrong. And that, of course, it raises questions for the Christian equally about why a loving God would allow such atrocities to occur. So if you're interested in reading that, then do go on to the blog, premierchristianity.com/blog. Right now, time to get into the final part of our discussion.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
So we've been talking about whether Islamic State really represents true Islam. Well, Jeremiah J. Johnson and Craig A. Evans in their new book, Jesus and the Jihadis, Confronting the Rage of ISIS and the Theology Driving the Ideology, say, like it or not, the wicked acts of Islamic State are justified from the pages of the Quran and the Jeremiah had described as the trilogy, the Hadith, the Sirah and the Quran. We've been hearing response both from Adnan Rashid of the Islamic Education and Research Academy and also Iniat Bunglawala of Muslims for UK. And Craig Evans has also joined us as well, a noted New Testament scholar. But throwing his hat in the ring there in that last section, Adnan, believing that there hasn't been enough response from the Muslim world to this threat that ISIS pose, and perhaps that's some kind of tacit, if you like, approval in some way of their act, or not willing to kind of step in and protect some of these people who are being murdered.
I think this is a very unfair statement, because Muslims have been condemning ISIS from the very point when they started to kill innocent people. That's where the problem is. ISIS are killing innocent people, and they are... they seem very sadistic about the way they're carrying on their business.
Mm-hmm. So that's an understatement.
Turkey,
I mean, when
Turkey
you see what
has
they
made
do.
It very yeah. clear that it's their policy to work against ISIS. Saudi Arabia is very vigilant about the issue. And Pakistani government has made many statements. Scholars all around the world, whether they are American scholars or whether they are Saudi scholars or they are scholars from Egypt, Al-Azhar. A lot of these scholars have come out clearly stating what is wrong with ISIS. And I'm talking about scholars from all kind of different backgrounds.
Yeah. But I think Craig's question is, why aren't they, you know, putting physically, their words into action? Why aren't they going there,
well, if,
repelling
if Craig,
ISIS?
Craig was to look at the situation carefully, some of the biggest fighters or fighting forces against ISIS are Muslims in Syria. There are other groups fighting against
Kurdish forces and so on. And
Kurdish or Jabhat al-Nusra. Kurdish are secular. They don't have a religion, in my opinion. Okay, they are PKK and they're communist, actually. Okay, so they don't really represent Islam. But there are other groups on the other side who are fighting ISIS. They have declared ISIS to be a problem. Okay, so please watch carefully. Do not look selectively. Don't be. Don't disregard or ignore Muslim condemnations. And we don't have to condemn all the way because we never created ISIS in the first place. As Anayat rightly pointed out, ISIS is a creation of the Christian world.
Is it? I'll tell you why.
I mean, I can be extreme like Craig and Jeremiah and claim that George Bush, a warrior sent by God who is a born-again Christian, he said, God is the one who told me to go to Iraq. And in order to remove one tyrant, you kill over 3 million people in 20 years. This is what you call a genocide.
We are moving towards final statements. And
very quickly, I just want to make the final statement. Craig interestingly pointed out fruit. You should know
people. A tree by its fruit.
Yeah, exactly. Look at the Islamic fruit. Look at the Islamic civilization. Our universities, our hospitals, our contribution to education, to tolerance, to coexistence, to justice, to peace around the world. Pick up any book. I mean, I have written a book on this. It's my opportunity to advertise my book now. You can find it online free of charge. It's in PDF. It's called Islam's War on Terror. It gives you some of the evidence as to how Islam made a difference to the world in a positive way. So can you please point out to that link as well?
We'll make it available. We'll make it available along with everyone's from the show page today. Jeremiah, as I say, starting to draw things to a close, you may want to respond to some of what Adnan had to say there. What's your take on all this?
Well, again, Justin, I want to thank you for putting the program together, and I thank Iniat and Adnan for joining us. In the very same country where our counterparts have said ISIS is being fought against, I think we need to make it clear to the audience, in those very same countries, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, others, over $40 million a year is being donated to the Islamic State. So there are clearly sympathizers within those same countries. And I think something that we could, an interesting point to end on, and perhaps we can talk about it in another program. When you look at the worst terrorist attack that ever took place on American soil, of course, I'm talking about 9/11. According to the 9/11 Commission report, that attack cost al-Qaeda somewhere in the neighborhood of $400,000 to $500,000 to execute. I want to make sure our audience understands the finances of the Islamic State. We don't need to guess. They've put out a budget. It cost $2 billion to run a modern caliphate, by the way. The Islamic State makes six times the amount it took to pull off 9/11 every single day. They make $3 million a day. So they have the resources to carry out their threats. Our audience has heard a lot of things on this in this interesting radio interview. We've heard about American atrocities, Israeli atrocities. We've heard that Christianity created ISIS. Craig and I have been compared to ISIS, the way we interpret the Bible, they interpret the Quran. I believe in the intelligence of our audience with the evidence that's been shared. My final comment, Justin, according to the Quran, beginning at 33:21, Muhammad is the divine human prototype. He is an excellent example of character. 91 times in the Quran, Muhammad is said to have excellent character. I encourage our audience, do a study for yourself. Does Muhammad have excellent character? What do you think about that? And I want to encourage you to make a decision for yourself.
It's been great having you on the program, Jeremiah. We will come to Craig as well in a moment. But first of all, Iniat, any final thoughts as we close out today's show?
First of all, thank you for inviting me. It's been
You're very welcome.
Show. Regarding our two American contributors today, I honestly wish that at a time when the world badly needs people to heal wounds and understand each other, instead of that, what we've heard from our American contributors is a very horrible portrayal of Islam, a very, very hurtful portrayal of Islam. I mean, one of the chapters in their book, chapter 11, is called Reforming Islam, the Cult of Death. So to find my faith described as the cult of death, I just ask your Christian listeners, imagine if someone, if a Muslim described your religion as the cult of death, how they would feel. It's enormously hurtful. I don't believe Christ would have used language like that about others. You know, his own example. I mentioned earlier. I read the Gospels and how he treated others, and how he would talk to others. He would never look down on them like that. So I'm disappointed that we've heard so many hurtful words today. The last statement we just heard, where someone said, "Look, if they want to find out more about Islam, go and read about the Prophet." I think that's probably the most sensible thing that's been said today. There are hundreds and hundreds of biographies of the Prophet written by Muslims, Christians, and others. So by all means, I would urge your listeners, go and read one by a Christian and read one by a Muslim and make up your own minds. That's the best way to learn. And never rely on anyone else, but go find out firsthand and study yourself.
If anyone is a regular listener to Unbelievable, that's what they come for. Two different points of view and making up their own mind. So thank you very much, Iniat, for bringing your thoughts to the table. Craig, as we finish, Iniat really believes that you've been very unfair to Islam in this book, that you're demonizing Islam. And that's not what you're aiming to do, though, is it, as far as you're concerned?
No, far from it. Not at all. I'm very concerned about Muslim people. I'm glad that most of them are, in fact, peace-loving and moderates, and I'm delighted to know that most, of course, do not support ISIS or any other form of terrorism. I think I would like to end on the same note just mentioned. Sure, read about Muhammad. Read about him. Read an Islamic biography, the traditional one. Read the Quran, and then also read all about Jesus and read the Gospels. Compare and make your own decision. I cast my vote for him who said, love your neighbors, pray for your enemies, and do things that are truly redemptive. And there's no destruction of people, no coercion, no threats, no death sentence against an apostate, somebody who leaves the faith, no fatwas, no forcing or coercion that way, but rather let your light shine and give to him who asks, and don't turn away anyone who is in need. That's the prophet, I think, that got it right, and that's why I'm a Christian.
Thank you very much for your contribution as well. Going to post links to both Craig and Jeremiah, and of course the book Jesus and the Jihadis from today's program, and indeed to Adnan's book as well, and of course a link to where you can find out more about Iniat. So all of that available from premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Gentlemen, it's been tricky fitting you all into an hour or so of talking, but we've managed it somehow. So thank you, gentlemen, all for being with me on the program today.
Thank you, Justin.
Thank you. Thank you. It's fantastic.
Thank you.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, let's hear some of your feedback to recent editions of the program. Once again, if you want to get in touch, it's unbelievable@premier.org.uk to leave your thoughts via email. You can comment under the latest edition of the program. That's at the website premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Or you can get in touch via Facebook and Twitter at unbelievablejb or facebook.com/unbelievablejb. So by email, Ricky, who's not an atheist, maybe an apostate from Edinburgh, says, here's a thought on last week's show. This was one of those shouting at the radio type shows. And to remind you, last week was Peter Atkins, David Glass and James Croft in discussion on the question of whether science has replaced God as an explanation. David Glass's thesis that actually scientific explanations do not replace God explanations, and James Croft and Peter Atkins arguing against him. So Ricky says this was one of those shouting at the radio type shows. David has clearly learned from masters of apologetics like William Lane Craig in that he wouldn't let his opponents shift the topic of conversation away from the very specific matter of his recent study. Every time they raised a valid argument, he said something like, we could discuss that, but, and then shifted the discussion back to the atheist straw man argument he was intent on attacking. But he felt no such constraints on his own side, throwing everything from intelligent design to the cosmological argument and fine-tuning into the mix whenever it suited him. He also repeatedly and perhaps deliberately failed to understand the arguments posed against him or dismissed the valid arguments as irrelevant. Very frustrating, says Ricky. This one from David Brugink says, Justin, let me start by saying thank you for consistently maintaining an amicable atmosphere for the guests on Unbelievable. I think that really makes a difference to the show and elevates the quality of its debates over other shows. I think it's a big part of why I continue to tune in each and every week. I wanted to write in particular, though, to make a suggestion for a guest on the show. Lately, I've really enjoyed the debates around questions such as whether science has adequately explained the universe or whether we still need the idea of God in society. However, I find myself coming away unconvinced by the arguments put forth by the Christian presenters, because they seem to me to boil down to an inability to reconcile science and theism. They seem to admit that science is continually finding ways to explain things formerly thought to be caused directly by God, but they argue that science will never be able to explain away anything entirely. However, science's track record in this regard is quite successful. So perhaps as a compliment to these debates, I want to suggest that Unbelievable hosts a guest that comes from the perspective of process theology. For instance, John Caputo, Catherine Keller, or Ilya Delio. According to process theology, science and God are not rivals, but are instead deeply intertwined. I think this viewpoint, set against that of a more traditional theist, or an atheist especially, would make for an immensely interesting debate. Thanks again, and keep up the wonderful work, says David. Thank you, David. Interesting suggestion. Here were some of the things that you said underneath the show on the website. Vector Ray said, science typically answers why questions with how answers. When scientists say they can explain scientifically why something happens, they're inadvertently answering how, or the mechanism causing it to happen. That's not a fault of science. To science, the why questions cannot be answered because they are merely illusions. Robert Parr says, has science explained away God? All the speakers accepted it hasn't. The objections raised were more agency explanations do not help us understand the phenomena in question, and so on. So it was agreed, scientific explanations do not rule out God. I agree, some apologists also make a positive case, and the best of luck to them, but to stick to the point, scientific explanations do not rule out God, and there's nothing wrong with repetition. Peter Atkins often describes religion as lazy. While I don't agree, I see no reason why he shouldn't say so and say it more than once. One repeats oneself because the penny hasn't dropped. So can we agree, scientific explanations do not rule out God? To which DNBJ13 responded, agreed, but that puts the Christian God in the same category as all the Greek gods, Babylonian gods, Hindu gods, and all other gods. In fact, no god has ever been completely ruled out by science. Leslie wanted to say, debates like this start out with a fundamentally wrong premise, especially from the atheist side, and the premise is that religion is a poor man's science. If you read a theology textbook, it won't sound much like a science textbook, and if you read a science textbook, it won't sound much like a theology textbook. There's a reason for that. The reason being they are fundamentally different things. Theology is about God. Science is about the physical world. That's why scientific and theistic worldviews can coexist in one and the same mind, and in such a mind as that, neither is superfluous. And Matt Herndon also weighed in, not on the subject as such, just to say, I only want to clarify that James Croft hails from my hometown of St. Louis, Missouri. It's spelled Louis, but pronounced Lewis here in the States. Justin inadvertently used the French pronunciation of St. Louis. We have so little going on here in St. Louis that we have to make sure people pronounce our city's name correctly. Go Cards, which I assume is your local baseball or football team. Matt, thank you very much. In fact, Matt got in touch with by email as well. He's a pastor, actually, out in St. Louis. And he says, my favorite theology professor at Bethel Seminary just became an atheist. His name is Laron Schultz, and he's written a book explaining his change of views. It's called Theology After the Birth of Gods and offers a biocultural interpretation of religion. The book's very interesting, entertaining, and challenging, and seems to open up a couple of new fronts on the religion debate. I think he'd make a great guest for your show, perhaps in a debate format. Thank you very much for getting in touch, Matt. Sounds like it could be a very interesting program if we were to do that, and I appreciate the suggestion. I've had a couple more emails from people who have been interested in getting in touch about various things. This one, for instance, from David Hardiman on Facebook said, I have a question from a friend who I truly believe is reaching for Christ. Being the mathematician and academic, he asked me the following. I'm wondering if you can recommend to me a good scholarly and above all neutral source or book or article that goes into detail about the differences in translations of the Bible and how they affect theological interpretation of Scripture. Because I have associates in philosophy and realize translation is everything. JWs play games with their translation, and as a result, you'll get a cult. Surely you see my concern. So David asks on behalf of his friend if I knew of any good books, neutral books, his friend asks for, on different translations of the Bible. I can't claim to know very much about books that go into detail on the different translations of the Bible that are out there. But there are some good books out there, obviously, on the Bible and how to read it well and the translation of it and so on, such as How to Read the Bible for All It's Worth by Gordon D. Fee. You might be a good place to start. As to whether you see that as neutral, obviously, well, can you get such a thing? It's a debate, isn't it, very often in theological circles. Is there any such thing as a neutral sort of take on the Bible? Everyone obviously comes to the Bible with a certain set of lenses, and so all I can say is obviously different perspectives will come through in different books. But if you've got a suggestion for David on that front, helpful resources on different translations of the Bible, perhaps you'd like to send them in. That's about all we've time for, though, on today's programme. Thank you for all of your responses on the programme today. And if you're busy typing out a response to today's show, I look forward to receiving that as well and reading it in a future edition of the programme. But we don't have a regular programme next week, but let me tell you what you will be hearing. You're unbelievable. Well, all of the next week is given over to our Together Now fundraising appeal. Premier Christian Radio does exist as a listener-supported station, so your financial giving is very important to us, and that's what will be taking the place of Unbelievable at this time next week. If perhaps you listen to the programme via podcast and you would like to support the Ministry of Premier, then of course you can do that by visiting premier.org.uk/together now. But if you're listening via podcast, I'll still be providing something into your podcast feed for next week's programme. So look out for that coming in. We've got the possibility, I think, of a debate between David Robertson and an atheist that was a public debate that took place recently. So we're still sorting out whether we can get the audio together for that, but that may well be what lands in your podcast feed at this time next week. Just a reminder, though, that the week after, we are doing this special show looking back at 10 years of Unbelievable, and I'd love your questions for it. So if you'd like to ask me any question, what would it be? I'll aim to answer it. Send in your thoughts to unbelievable@premier.org.uk or get in touch via the Facebook and Twitter accounts. And for the moment, thank you very much for being with me on today's show. I'm going to leave you in the capable hands of Maria Rodriguez. Her guest on The Profile is Helen Shapiro.